to the Legal Digest podcast. This is your host, Natalie, and today I'm joined by Robin De Meyer. Robin is a trainee patent attorney for one of the biggest IP firms in Europe. He also holds a DPhil in material science from Oxford University, where he focused on the micromechanics of ceramic matrix composites. Outside of the law and academia, he is a professional dancer, the UK's top flow dancer, founder of the Oxford University Pole Sports, an Olympic level judge and a model. Thanks for joining me today, Robin.
Thank you for having me, Natalie.
No problem. I was really looking forward to talking to you because it's so rare to see lawyers showing their personality and like not being afraid to, even if it's things which you wouldn't normally expect people to do. So I really want to talk to you about that. And also what kind of drives you to do all these different things. So firstly, can you tell us more about your career so far and why you decided to specialise in IP law?
Yeah, sorry, thanks for having me, first of all. And I'm always so excited to talk about these things because it's something that drives me so much. And also, I just have to point out first that I work under someone who is currently just becoming partner, and she is like my role model. She's so badass. Just on the side note, she's like obviously a qualified attorney and super high level partner, but she's also like a mother of two with a husband. And then on the side of being an attorney, and she also has a PhD in science and everything, she's also like a professional painter, a professional archer, and a professional taekwondo instructor. And it's like, how can you be this badass, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
is this one so
back
person?
To me.
Are you sure?
Back to me. So who am I? I'm Robin. I had a very weird career trajectory. So I'm going to go from the very beginning. I actually did the French baccalaureate in Hong Kong. When you do the French baccalaureate, you specialize in 16 different subjects. You do the equivalent of 16 different A-levels. So I did everything from the fine arts to every science, to history, philosophy, whatever. And then when I finished, I really didn't know what to do. So I decided to go for what I thought at the time was one of the broadest disciplines ever, which was material science and engineering as a whole. Because in material science, you basically touch upon everything that's material around you. So basically everything you see is material science. So I was like, okay, you can't go broader than that. So I picked that. And then halfway through my degree at Imperial in London, this is where I arrived to the UK. I specialized and I started doing a double degree in aerospace engineering because I really liked aerospace. Well, it sounded interesting. And then I finished and I went to MIT to do my master's. And then I came back to the UK to Oxford to do a PhD. The reason I did a PhD was just because I actually lost, for circumstances that are out of my control, I lost the job offer that I wanted to have at my sponsor, my PhD sponsor. And as like a plan B, as a consolation prize, they were like, okay, how about you do a PhD that is sponsored by us so that you're still able to work for us when you finish, but you also, you know, don't lose a year or whatever. So I did this PhD, went to Oxford because my sister and my dad were both there and I was like, why not? And then I finished my PhD and then I had a massive, massive quarter life crisis during the pandemic. So during the first lockdown, I was like, I don't want to be an engineer anymore. So I kind of gave that up and then I started thinking of alternative career path. And as I was looking around, I realized that a lot of the alumni from my research group, after their PhD in engineering and material science, had all shifted to IP law, and I had no clue what IP law was. So I like started Googling, started contacting people who were lawyers, and then I realized that IP law was so badass because it's, I mean, basically the most famous IP lawyer is Einstein, right? So everyone's like, oh, you're the next Einstein, like, you know, doing some law thing on the side. So I was like, yeah, I can be a qualified scientist, PhD engineer, and then also do the like qualified to legal side, and then nobody can take my job away from me because, you know, IP law is so overly qualified that the job market is saturated. So I decided to do that. In the meantime, I also worked in fashion, venture capital, I did loads of things. But yeah, I basically stuck to law, and I realized the more I was looking into it, the more I was talking to IP lawyers, who, by the way, are some of the people that I think have the best quality of life, but also are the most satisfied with their job career. Like I haven't met or spoken to, I met one, spoken to a single person who didn't like what they did and didn't enjoy what they were doing day to day. So I thought, okay, sounds fulfilling, sounds very intellectually stimulating, sounds well rewarded financially, and it's like in big cities, and it's exactly what I was looking for. So yeah, I decided to apply for jobs, and then I got into Hoffmann Eitler, and now been working for them for a year, still training. My traineeship, traineeships for IP law are a bit different from traditional law in the sense that you pass all these like equivalent bar exams, this like patent attorney qualifications. So I'll be training for 2-3 more years and then I'll be fully qualified.
Nice. That sounds really, I mean, what better reason to specialize in IP law if you get the perfect work-life balance? Sounds really
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
So I mean, you touched a little bit on your DPhil. So, what was the reason for specializing in a science subject?
That's a good question. So I think I've just always been a scientist or an engineer by trade. So back at the French baccalaureate, I just realized that I was just better at scientific subjects. So I just stuck with that. And to be honest, it was more of a default choice. It's not something that's driven. And I also, we're going to talk about my dancing later, but I have a very strong philosophy in that I think that people should never pursue their passion as a career. It sounds so horrible, but I definitely think that you should always keep your passion as a hobby on the side and make sure that you nurture it and then you spend money into your hobby that you enjoy doing. And that you should really see your career professionally. You should see it responsibly. You should treat it responsibly. You should see it as something that's just your bread earning, making activity. And so it for me, I just did science because it was default. I was told I was good at it. Doesn't mean that I liked it, but I was told I was good at it. So I kept doing it. And yeah, so I spoke about how I've found material science. I thought it was a broader subject. And yeah, to be honest, I just fell into law after, but the whole reason I did a PhD all the way to science was out of my control. It was just people told me to do it, so I did it very much.
It's interesting that you say keeping your passions and your work separate, because some people try to combine them and turn their passions into a business. So what you're saying is actually keeping them separate is better.
From my experience, and I think from the people I've seen around me, in the sense that I think I have too many friends who have gone, especially into the world of dancing or singing professionally and theater and drama, and who the majority of them have ended up hating their passion. It sounds so pessimistic of me, but a lot of them just see their activities and their passions now as how can I make more money day to day? How can I invest more into XYZ? How can I develop my business? And I see it as, oh my God, like I want to go dancing at the end of the day because I want to express my creativity. I want to enjoy myself. So
Yeah.
it's, I think it's just those two contrasts. Yeah, most
Yeah.
of the
Can
thing.
hinder the creative process.
100%.
Yeah. And so you've got many achievements, both career and outside of the law. So do you find a way to connect these together?
Yeah, so whilst I say you should keep them, so I didn't say you should keep them separate, by the way. I said that you should always keep your true passion, the something that the fire inside you should keep that as non-professional. You could do it to a
Okay.
professional level, but you shouldn't have it as your 100% business, money earning activity. So yeah, I think I've always been a proponent of interdisciplinarity, pluridisciplinarity as a whole. Even during like the French baccalaureate, I said we study a total of 15, 16 subjects. So I was studying history of art, and then I was studying also like Chinese history in Chinese. Like it was all these crazy subjects that didn't make sense together, but I kind of enjoyed the diversity of it all. And then when I chose engineering as a whole, I actually was more on the design forefront. So at Imperial now, there's a new course called design engineering. I would have loved to have done that if it was available back when I started because I am so old. And so
I don't
I feel
believe
like
that.
I feel like design engineering is exactly what I was going for. It's something that you have engineers collaborate with designers and more creative minds, and then they come up with products. Like product design, I think is an amazing like crossroads, at the crossroads type of industry of discipline. And I would have loved to do that 100% if I had the opportunity. So at Imperial, there was the Royal College of Art, for example, next to the campus. So that was super helpful because I met a lot of creative minds there. There was also a design lab back when I was at the MIT. That was super cool. All the undergrads there were all so creative. They were all like engineer scientists, but at the same time, they had these crazy, like, let's have these fashion show runways where people would like come down from the sky and these are the load force they're going to be on. Like it was crazy. And then obviously, as I was doing my engineering degrees, I also worked as a model first, but then I switched to trend forecasting. So I worked in fashion basically. I was at basically all the fashion weeks every September and January season when you didn't have any lectures. And at first, I got hired as a kind of consultant materials database for runways. It was all like I was just investigating, oh, this garment is now made of pineapple skin. This is novel. And then I would just like put it down on the database. But then they really liked what I was doing on the fashion side of things. And then I started doing more fashion. And anyways, as a whole, I felt like I stood out of all the other engineers in my cohort because I was doing something so creative on the side. It was so different from engineering and science. So yeah, I've always been a proponent. And then nowadays in my legal career, I feel like there's other aspects that have started creeping in because I am now starting to represent clients within the dance world. I don't know if I can say this. I think I can. And obviously, right now, the majority of my work anyway lies in the intersection between, high-end technology sciences and, developing new legal frameworks to protect those. So I think I'm IP law as a whole is already an interdisciplinary industry, like field. And now dance is creeping in through like, trademarks, copyrights, designs. And so I really enjoy that from IP. I think people think IP is very obviously extremely specialized, and I actually think it's extremely broad and diverse compared to other types of law where you could specialize in like contract law and whatever. So yeah, I'd say it's pretty pluridisciplinary.
Okay. And then I noticed that you, it, I think it mentions on your LinkedIn page that you identify as a third culture individual. So for listeners that may not have heard of this before, what does that mean and how do you identify as that?
So, first of all, I started using the word third culture individual because I was using the word third culture kid, and then I was told off by someone who told me that TCK is kind of like condescending because it's abbreviated to TCK, right? That's like the I think that's the common jargon used worldwide, and so now I'm using TCI individual just to be a bit more inclusive. And so, I think what it means is that at TCI you basically never feel like you have a home. That's like the downfall of it. Obviously, there's loads of perks, and you're privileged enough to have like a background of different cultures, but it basically means that I don't identify as belonging to any country or borders or having any nationalities. It just means that I'm born, raised, and I'm from two parents that are from four different countries, and then I'm also in now a fifth country and living in another culture that I don't identify as being part of. And so yeah, third culture individual just refers to, I guess, a range of people that don't feel like they belong anywhere. And that sounds so pessimistic. But yeah, so I was born in Japan. My mom's Taiwanese, my dad's Belgian, and then I was raised in Hong Kong at the French school. And now I've been in the UK for 10 years, and I just got the British passport last year, actually. And so
Congratulations.
thank you. It was a hell of a hurdle, but it happened. And yeah, it just means that I've like modeled for mixed race faces agencies. I don't know if you know those. Those are like other charities that promote mixed race faces. I was also a contributing author of the and committee member of the Oxford Mixed Heritage Society. And yeah, again, I feel like being a third culture individual just means that it's both a privilege and a curse in the sense that you're super open-minded to other cultures, obviously. But at the same time, I find the concept of like patriotism very hard to grasp. So for example, people are like football matches, rugby matches, and they're all cheering for a specific team.
Yeah.
I couldn't care less if Belgium, Hong Kong, Taiwan, anyone was playing. I was rooting for like the individual players, the skill level, the team spirit, fair enough. But the concept of associating a team with a country for me is very alien, literally and metaphorically.
Yeah, I agree actually. I think it would be so much better actually if there was a world without borders in the
Yeah,
sense
I
of.
mean, now it sounds like we're all anarchists, but all
I
I'm
know.
saying is, I think it's just harder for me, for example, to serve in any military. I find the concept of dying for one's country, yeah, again, a very strange to grasp concept, and I couldn't relate.
Yeah. So let's talk about your interests outside of the law. You founded the Oxford University Pole Sports. Can you tell us more about that and why you decided to do it?
Yes, and by the way, pole is something I could talk to for days. But yeah, pole is really weird, so it's obviously a huge taboo, I guess, in the legal industry as well. So I'm going to talk about that as well. But pole is something I started. I actually chose Imperial because I saw that there was a pole dancing society back when I was like choosing unis, and I was like, oh, that's so lit. All the engineers are now, developing baby strippers. I was like, cool, let's do that. So I joined Imperial, and then I went to Freshers' Fair. I saw this guy Ben, who was like this massive hunk, who was like a circus artist, and he was also doing his PhD in math. It was crazy. And he was the president at the time, and I spoke to him at Freshers' Fair, and I told him, "Look, I actually chose Imperial because I saw there was your pole dancing society, which sounds so lit." Which, by the way, the society itself at Imperial was founded by a Google software engineer, which is so cool. And yeah, so I went to pole, a few taster sessions, and then I, fell in love with it immediately. I started going every day, literally every day. In my second year as well, I became president of the club by emergency, and I ended up training 22, 23 hours a week. Like it was basically my full-time job, and my studies were very much secondary to my life. Don't tell that to the deans of degrees. But yeah, and now I've grown all the way 10 years later, 10 years later, and I'm now, a professional judge at the World Port Sports, which are the equivalent of the Olympics. And I'm a national champion in exotic flow, which is heel-based artistry. So When I describe pole is kind of like an umbrella term for those of many disciplines within it. So there's like Chinese pole, which is what you see in the circus, which is like fully clothed. The pole itself is like made of rubber, not of steel. You have pole sports, which is kind of like what the Olympics of pole are. It's very much gymnastics, but on the pole. And then you have like the typical pole dance. Pole fitness is kind of like Pilates, what you see in fitness gyms, what you get offered as gyms. And then you have like heels poles. Some people call it exotic pole, very controversially. And it basically means it's just a full-on dance style, right? It's not related to, or it's very much less related to sports as pole sports. And so I decided to specialize myself in loads of those different umbrella terms. And now I feel like I've reached a good, decent level in all of them. And I'm really happy wherever I've. And when I arrived in Oxford 4 years into coming to the UK, I realized there was no pole dance club at Oxford. And it was actually the last university in the entirety of the UK that didn't have a pole dance club.
Really?
That's how A, Oxford is so conservative. And B, how actually it had developed so popularly in every other university, even Cambridge had one. And so for me, the UK was very progressive in that, universities were allowing pole dancing clubs to flourish and thrive. And especially in contrast to MIT, where I had just been from. And there's only two unis in the US that have a pole club, Brown and Cornell, and that's it. No one else has a pole dance club. And so I thought the UK is doing so well and Oxford is doing so poorly. And I think I've reached a state in my life where I feel like I could push this. So I made the pole sports club. I purposefully called it pole sports club, one of the sub umbrella terms, because I wanted to like reach out for funding and get funding from the Olympics. So it was a whole I could talk to about it for days. But basically, I made the club. It was a really, really big struggle when I first started because, for example, I was filming a trailer for the club, and a lot of the colleges were telling me off, saying that I couldn't film in the undergrounds because, I would offend church XYZ or whatever. And so for me, it was kind of like, I can't believe these people are all coming against me whilst I'm qualifying as an Olympic judge. Like it was all very much like I'm confused and lost. The stereotypes are still there, the prejudice is still there, and I couldn't grasp it because I was surrounded in a world that was full of bubblegum princesses and everything was nice. So it was hard for me to take it in. And so I ended up making the club with a lot of trouble, and now it's grown into this massive 16 committee member, 20 instructors on rota, so many members. So it's now grown out of proportions, which I'm really happy about. And yeah, I've kind of delegated it to the rest of the Oxford people, my babies. So yeah, and now I'm still a pole dancer in London, still judging, still competing. Just came back from San Diego last week to compete at the international version of what I won in November for the UK. So yeah,
Okay.
that's pole.
How did you become an Olympic level judge then?
So that's also a whole conversation of its own. So in general, every 4 years at the Olympics, you have 14 sports that are called observer sports. Then they're granted by the GSF, which is another external body. And out of all these 14 sports, the host of the next Olympic Games decides usually between six or seven sports that make it to the actual games. So for example, in Paris, we have 14 sports that are lined up, and Paris are going to pick seven of them, be like, you guys have qualified to be in the Olympics for this season. And pole is one of the 14 sports for the 2024, including against other sports like poker and foot golf and octopus, which I'm like, what? Anyways, but I'm just excited for people to maybe see pole dancing in the Olympics. And so if pole is about to be the Olympics, we obviously have to train a lot of people to just judge worlds every year so that people qualify for the Olympics in the event that it does happen. And so I'm basically qualified to do that. So I've been a judge since 2019, right before the pandemic. I basically went through a series of qualifications. It's almost like passing the bar. It's actually quite challenging. And the pass rate is quite low, or it's not quite low, it's half. And so, yeah, I've been doing that. I judged actually my last one, I think, last July, yeah, 3 weeks ago. And I don't think I will want to do it again, actually, because it's taken a lot of my time and I'm doing it out of pure goodwill. So, anyways.
Something you enjoy, but yeah, it
Yeah,
sounds like you're really
exactly.
busy,
Yeah.
work and everything. Yeah, well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank
That brings us
you.
to the end of this episode. You can find Robin on social media, the details of which will be in this episode's description. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave a rating and a review. If you have any questions on the discussions we covered today, you can contact us by email or on social media.